longtime show regular and favourite William Tyler on Sideways Through Sound. And as I mentioned at the top of that tune, well, aren't we lucky? Yes, indeed. William Tyler is here in the studio with me on Sideways Through Sound. Welcome all the way from Nashville, William Tyler.
Hey, Mark, how are you doing?
Yeah, very good, mate. It's an absolute pleasure to have you here. Regular listeners to the programme will have been hearing your records on Sideways Through Sound for a very long time now, and I would like to start off our chat with a kind of a quick look back to those very early days for you as a solo artist. Coming from a background of playing in groups, what was it that made you decide to pursue a solo career?
When I started making solo records, it was that, you know, there wasn't really an end game in mind. I think even when you have a band, it doesn't matter if you're just practicing in your basement or something, there's already three or four other people's egos and goals involved. And I wanted to make music. I was listening to a lot of things like Six Organs and Nurse with Wound and a lot of home recorded type things like that, and there was no end game to it. I was just wanted to make music at home on my 4-track, and you know, I had a digital 8-track, and which is how I made the first couple of tapes that I made. But I didn't feel comfortable necessarily sharing it with people, so I was trying to set the disappointment ceiling really, really low, so that, like, you know, it wasn't. And then it just kind of grew. It just started growing, and you know, and at the time, I mean, I was in bands with singer-songwriters, but I wasn't listening to singer-songwriter music anymore. So just, you know, these acoustic songs would sort of take place, and I just didn't feel like writing lyrics anymore, and I certainly didn't want to be singing. So it just kind of organically moved in that direction. And then I think at some point it just was clear, like, okay, well, this is, I found my voice. This might not always be my voice, but this is what it is for now. And I'm just going to kind of go full tilt into it and learn as much about this style of music and how to play it as possible.
Okay. Well, there's a couple of things that you mentioned there that kind of, I want to touch on with the next question for you, because the first album you released under the name Paper Hats, mm-hmm. and I'm thinking some of those like tapes might have sort of composed some of those recordings, mm-hmm. even. Was having a pseudonym or a kind of a band name a conscious throwback to having played in groups where, you know, before you could perhaps be a little more anonymous?
I feel like at the time, a lot of the people I was, like, thinking about, like, I mean, the Silver Jews I played with, but also Smog, also Papa M, also Six Organs of Admittance, Nurse with Wound, like, essentially these are all one person's recording project. Yeah. That's really what I was trying to, like, conjure. And what was funny about it was that almost instantly, as soon as I started playing shows, like, everybody just started asking me, why are you not just going as William Tyler? Right. And at the time I was trying to, like, react against what I felt like was the singer-songwriter ego culture of Nashville of, like, you know, you have to go by your name. It has to be so direct. You know, I have my issues with Josh, who put out Behold the Spirit, but some of his first advice was the best advice. He was just like, this doesn't need to be the Paper Hats. This is William Tyler.
Yeah,
like,
right.
Just get rid of that. And I wish I had done it the whole time. But I don't know. I guess that was part of me being kind of insecure and, you know, thinking that shrouding something in some kind of mystery was more, you know, useful than it actually was at the time.
Okay. Yeah, look, what you've just said there is, it's not the first time I've heard that from someone who's kind of embarked on a similar journey to yourself.
Yeah.
And some of those musicians that you mentioned there as well, like Smog and Six Organs, they, like yourself, are often referred to as solo musicians, which is kind of a misnomer really, because particularly for yourself, most of your recorded output features a number of additional players. So when it comes to writing songs, William, how do you compose? Is it principally for one instrument with options for other players to join in later, or do you have this kind of grand vision of how these songs are going to ultimately turn out?
I definitely, the longer I do it, the more I'm writing for I'm consciously writing for other instruments, even if I'm like writing the parts out on the guitar. You know, I'll be like, okay, no, this line, this melody line is going to be a piano line, or this is a violin line, or something like that. Yeah, I mean, I hear lots of parts in my head. Goes West, I think, when we recorded that, just not to divert the topic, but I mean, I didn't really tell anybody what to play on that. I mean, there were really busy guitar melodies that I felt like were sort of the, if anything, they were like the vocal lines of the songs. And then everybody else who played on the record, I just trusted them, you know, implicitly to just add whatever parts.
Well, is that because you knew them as musicians, and then there's a kind of a certain energy between you and understanding already because you've played before?
Well, I mean, like, all, like, on Modern Country, like, there's probably, like, 12 to 13 tracks of guitar on every song.
Wow.
And I played all of the guitar parts on the whole record.
Right.
And on Goes West, I only played one guitar track per song, and it's the lead acoustic part. One of them I think I doubled, but everything else on it is either keyboards or it's Meg playing the electric guitar.
Yeah.
And that was a conscious choice for myself of like, no, I'm going to step back. Like, I'm not going to play electric guitar on this record. I'm going to, the Meg's ideas are going to fill that space. Or in one song, Bill Frisell overdubbed on it, which was a huge, like, bucket list goal.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, it just varies. And the next record's probably going to be more me-centric, more electric, probably. I don't know.
Well, the live set last night must have been a sound technician's dream to set up, because it's basically a chair, one combo cab, a few pedals, which I believe you brought yourself, and a microphone. And for someone who doesn't sing, you put that microphone to very good use. And I just wondered, has storytelling always been a part of a William Tyler live show?
It really developed after the first time I did a tour with the British folk artist. He would hate for me calling him folk, but I'm sorry. He is. He has an acoustic guitar. Michael Chapman.
Oh, yes.
And
he can spin a yarn, that fella, can he?
He can. He's hilarious.
Yeah.
And I, doing a two-week tour with him, you know, he told the same jokes and the same stories every single night, between, you know, but just that's what comedians do too. I mean, they, you know, they have their set. So I really started opening up after that tour. Before then, no, I was completely like awkward indie rock American, you know, playing like noise shows with five people, you know, and like nobody talks, and it's just like, you know, I mean, that's fine also. Like sometimes that's not the vibe, you know. There are definitely sets I play where there's no talking, you know. Like, I'm playing, there's visuals in the background. Yeah, I mean, that's not always, it's not always like that set. But I, you know, for that kind of crowd as last night where you were at, it's just, that's, it just helps the show breathe and it gives context to the songs. I think what I do is, you know, I make a very specific kind of music that is in between, you know, the folk world and the, you know, modern classical world, I think, and it lives in a very specific space, but there's room for storytelling in it.
At the show last night, you talked a lot about America, and a couple of things really caught my attention, and one was how much space and the desert and the wilderness parts of the US really has affected the music that you compose. So when did you first notice or recognize this connection to your country or this aspect of your country?
I started noticing it in a really heavy, visceral way in 2013 and 2014 when I was touring solo for the album Impossible Truth. And my booking agent had booked me a couple of really interesting tours that involved me literally driving across the country for the first time. And also driving up, you know, all around the Midwest and New England and just everywhere, really. And with a few exceptions, I was doing all these trips completely by myself. And I just got to have these incredibly meditative drives through weird... And because it wasn't anybody else's schedule, I would usually allow an hour or two extra on some of these drive days to take back roads instead of taking interstates.
Yeah, nice.
So you go through these like dying small towns and all these weird little, like, you just, it's like going back in time, you know? And I started kind of getting obsessed with that aspect of America, that there's this kind of parallel America that like doesn't really exist in mainstream culture, and you know, of course, sadly, most of it is Trump country. But a lot of it's not, you know, and a lot of it's the opposite of that, and you know, a lot of it's not white either. You know, people just assume it's like, oh, it's just white. It's like, no, it's rural America is very diverse in its own way, and I don't know. I just, there was something about that, and that really informed the philosophy behind Modern Country and Goes West. They're very exploratory records, trying to get at something about the soul of the country.
Mm. Well, that's interesting, because as I started flicking through your back catalogue, I started recognizing a bit of a visual theme to your album covers, and then thinking about something else you said last night, I was certain almost that there was some psychedelic influence to your music all along. Goes West is a bit of a change in theme on the album covers, supremely lysergic album cover. Mm-hmm. And then last night there was a mention of taking doses and listening to Joni Mitchell. Mm-hmm. So the cat is out of the bag now. Do you consider your music to have a psychedelic element?
I do. I mean, most people don't. So it's an interesting conversation. I mean, right now in America, psychedelic, the word is enjoying a renaissance. I'm sure it is here too. But, you know, there's this very sort of, you know, psychedelic drugs are starting to kind of become back in vogue. And psychedelic music is kind of meaning something. But it's interesting because it, with a few exceptions, like, I'm just thinking of like psychedelic music festivals in America. They're very predicated around electric music.
Mm-hmm.
Not necessarily just like loud electronic or electric, you know, but electronic and like ambient music. It's just things that, but all textures that are generated by electronic instruments, synthesizers, electric guitars, you know, whatever, drums, effects processors. It's rare that you feel like there's room in that culture for acoustic music, and I understand why. I mean, acoustic music is just is always in America is just assumed to be folk music, and when you're from Nashville, it doesn't help. You know, they just assumed you're country music.
Mm-hmm.
So I feel like if I can at least be put in some category of stuff that's more like what I would call chamber music, like that's a victory to me, because at least that's not folk music or country music. But I certainly think it's psychedelic. I mean, you know, there's a lot of textural things. I don't think Goes West is necessarily a very psychedelic record, although there's probably five tracks of synthesizer on every song. So they're just subliminally mixed sometimes. I don't know. Yeah, I don't know. The reason that I feel confident about talking about what I do is only because I just don't think it's easily I don't know what is the word. It's not categorized very easily. And it checks certain boxes of a lot of different genres, but it doesn't fit easily in any of them.
I think that's maybe from a marketing perspective, that's not ideal, but someone who enjoys your music, I think that's a perfect place to be.
Well,
you know?
I mean, it is what it is. It's
and
personal.
I never know what's coming next. Yeah. Every William Tyler record has a new dimension to it as well. So, and you know, last night you were you actually, it wasn't the track you finished on. I thought it was going to be the track you finished on. Those couple of metallic coloured boxes at your feet kind of went into overdrive at the end of one of the tunes. That was very acidic for someone who was sitting there with an acoustic guitar. And although sadly we don't have those boxes with us in the studio, you have very kindly agreed to play a couple of songs. So what would you like to play for us first, William? And if you want to give a bit of a background story to the song you're choosing, that would be great as well.
Well, this song is called Man in a Hurry, and you reminded me last night that what did you say? Haste is not a virtue.
There is no dignity
There's
in
no
haste.
No dignity in haste.
That wasn't a direct reference to this.
No,
song,
I know. It's just making. I'm just thinking about it now. There isn't, Mark. There's no dignity in haste.
There isn't.
Unless you're a running back in American football. No, this, long story short, the Man in a Hurry is specifically a reference to a title of an Andy Griffith episode, which I don't need to go into here because I'm sure the Andy Griffith Show is not being shown anywhere in Australia. But as a Southerner, it's something you grow up watching reruns of. But it's just meant to imply that there is a lot of dignity in stepping back and not getting ahead of yourself, mentally, physically, spiritually, musically. And I deal with pretty significant anxiety problems. Like, I got diagnosed with generalized anxiety disorder when I was like 13 or 14. And so most of my life as a conscious young adult and adult has been finding ways of combating that. And music is definitely one of the main ones. So I think that this song is just sort of supposed to be a reference to that.
Okay. On Sideways Through Sound, I am live in session with William Tyler, and William is going to play the first tune this evening on the program. That is Man in a Hurry. Live in session on Sideways Through Sound right here on 2SER 107.3. That is William Tyler with the first tune this evening, Man in a Hurry. Yes, I am chatting with William Tyler here in the 2SER studios. Now, William, you're born and bred Nashville. That's right, yeah?
Yep.
And Nashville, I have been there, of course, and it seems to be the home of country music. And I must confess, I know very little about country music. In fact, what I should have done is where my Whiskey Bent Saloon t-shirt. I had a really good night in the Whiskey Bent Saloon.
Oh, wait. Is that the one that you were wearing last night?
I had a Tombstone, Arizona t-shirt on last night.
I just saw the font looked like Jack Daniels, so I just assumed
it
was
does, doesn't it? Yes, it does. So I just wondered, being from Nashville, you talked about where you feel your music sits somewhere between a bunch of genres. How has Nashville influenced you as a musician, do you think?
The biggest influence on me as a musician growing up in Nashville is that there really is this special tradition of music. It's not very hierarchical. It's certainly not, I can't think of the word for, like, you know, a prejudice against age. But it's not that either. It's like country music, the best parts of country music represent the best parts of honest, like, populist America, you know, just like Bruce Springsteen, you know, or whatever. It's just like, you know, it's not a diverse culture, you know, musically. I wish it was. I mean, there's also a really long, almost as long and paralleled as country music, of R&B and soul and now rap culture in Nashville. But it's not a diverse musical city. You know, it's, I think my connection to it is I grew up around a lot of it. My parents worked in the publishing business, and a lot of my dad and mom's friends were musicians. So I always had this sort of, I was always around guitars and people, and just, you know, I didn't listen to any country music until I was probably in my mid 20s.
Okay.
You know, consciously. I would say that it's, you know, it's a city of about 700,000-800,000 people, but it's also always in the conversation with New York, Los Angeles, and like London for like music business, global music business centers. Mm. And when you think about how much smaller it is than all of those cities, that alone should tell you something about what's special about it.
Yeah.
I love it. I mean, I miss it a lot, but it's home, you know, and I've watched what's changed about it in the last 10 years. And, you know, some things are great because there's a lot of good restaurants, and a lot of things are terrible because people are being priced out of where they live, and it falls a lot along racial lines, and it's just, you know, but the energy of the place is genuinely, I think, pretty positive and friendly.
Well, I'd like to dig a little bit deeper into some of what you've just said, and again, connecting with something you talked about last night, and this is probably going to be a bit of a musical history lesson for me. Because another great insight last night was your reference or your conversation around what you described as music from the West of America. Mm-hmm. And you described it as like this melting pot of influence. So first of all, can you tell me, where do you consider that line to be, if there is a kind of an imaginary line? What's the West? Like, where does that start? And obviously it finishes at the water, but where does that start?
Well, I just read a book about called The End of the Myth, which is it's an American author, but it's actually funny you ask that, because the whole book is kind of a history of what the concept of the West is or was. And, you know, in the 18th century, the West was Kentucky and Pennsylvania.
Mm. Yeah.
You know, and then it was Missouri, you know, and then it was Kansas, you know, Texas, and then of course it was California and the Northwest. I think the West begins really where, geographically, where, you know, we cross the Mississippi, and then you drive about 2 hours, and suddenly everything just flattens out. Like, it just feels like you don't, and the sky opens up, and you're entering the Great Plains. And that, to me, is where the West begins.
Okay.
And then it just continues till you get to the Pacific. And I think what I was talking about last night was just that there's this... That song I played, Alpine Star, it's like my attempt at trying to combine all the different things that I would imagine that, like, in the 1870s you would have heard in, like, a Western mining town. Like, you would have heard, like, ragtime, you know, African-American music. You would have heard, like, Celtic and English-influenced folk. You would have heard Chinese folk. You would have heard Mexican folk. You would have heard Eastern European and German music. And that song is actually sort of my... And, of course, Native American music. trying to find little themes and commonalities into that, into like all these different sections of that one particular song.
So is the genre country and Western, is that name born out of this?
Yeah, there was a division
and melting
pot.
Now
well. It doesn't mean anything.
Yeah.
I mean, but honestly, most country music coming out of Nashville now just sounds like, you know,
Dwight Yoakam.
No, God, we wish. No, it sounds like Journey and like Survivor records.
Oh, is that right?
Banjos. Yeah,
okay,
yeah,
right.
No, it's not country anymore. But
do you know what? Outside of Johnny Cash, he's probably one of the five country music people I could think
who
of.
Who are the
anyway.
Other four?
The guy who's a bit of a rebel, who I kind of, I like him, I think I'd like him as a person, but I don't know what his music is. He's a kind of an older guy, always wears a headband.
Oh, Waylon Jennings? No, David Allan Coe?
Maybe Waylon Jennings.
Well, Waylon Jennings.
Bit of a wild man.
I mean, that doesn't narrow down a lot of people.
No. See, I told you I don't know much about
so
country music.
Well, historically, country and Western references the fact that country was, you know, the industry started in Tennessee, in Nashville, and New York, and Virginia. The first recording sessions were like Jimmy Rogers and the Carter Family were recorded were in Virginia.
And that would that have its like roots in hillbilly music?
Of course.
Yeah.
Hillbilly music was so directly linked to Anglo, Scotch-Irish folk music. I mean, down to the fact that like some of these ballads that like people play in the Highlands of Scotland.
Yeah,
like,
right.
They landed in Appalachia completely unchanged. Western really references the fact that in the 30s there started being this movement with like Texas and Oklahoma, a different kind of cowboy culture, a different kind of, the music was a little bit different. It was a little more jazz influenced. It was definitely more about, you know, it was trying to compete with big band music, essentially ballroom dancing. And at some point, I don't know if they ever merged, but I guess they kind of did.
But there wasn't always an and between country and Western, though, was there?
I don't know when that differentiated. Hillbilly music was kind of what it was called for the first 20 years. Country and Western. I mean, now, yeah, I don't. I mean, I, now it's just country.
Country, yeah.
And I think we're really, and now it's just more of like a, it's not even a musical style as much as just like an identity of, you know, just a certain kind of attitude. I don't even know if it really, but I'm like, indie rock doesn't mean anything anymore.
No.
I was talking to somebody about like, yeah, they're looking for indie rock. And they started naming all these, it was for this project. I'm sure it was like Amazon. It was some huge tech company. It was like, they're looking for indie rock bands like War on Drugs and The National and, Lana Del Rey. And I was like, these are all people who are on major labels. I know. Well, indie rock, it just means an aesthetic now. It doesn't mean...
Indie doesn't mean independent.
No,
anymore,
exactly. I'm
it?
Like,
that's
well,
right.
I'm on an actual independent label. Like, yeah. Merge is like one of the few record labels who's never taken any money from a major label, still owned by the same people who started it, you know. So
is that important to you?
Yes, it is. That's not to say I wouldn't work with a major label. But no, it is important. I think at this point, if you're in the music business, you know, you're either surrendering to the hegemony of corporations, you know, or you're trying to do your own thing and hopefully work in tandem with some of them, because you know you can't. I'm not anti Spotify. I use Spotify. I've done projects with them even. It's not even about smashing the system even more. It's just like making the system work for average people, you know, and that's politically what's going on too. I mean, it's like, you know, like we're not going to outlaw Wall Street. We should just, you know, you know, regulate them. You know, we need to make these companies accountable to working with us more equitably, but like they're going to be there, you know, like this is the way people consume music now, and that's okay. You know, a lot of people were terrified of, phonographs, you know, the sheet music people were the ones fighting that tooth and nail, and like, you know, it's just things change.
When you guest programmed for Sideways Through Sound last year, William, I'd like to talk about indie rock. Actually, I wouldn't like to talk about indie rock, but
so, well, we have to. Yeah.
Look, the selections that you made, they were rather eclectic.
I don't remember what I picked.
Well,
Juliana had a song, right?
She did, yes,
yeah.
That's right. And last night at the show, you played some classical music.
Yeah.
And I think you might have even done a Haydn song on one of your Aquarium Drunkard recordings as well. on a 12-inch that you released, there's a Michael Rother cover.
Uh-huh.
And those Michael Rother albums,
they're the best.
They're exemplary. Yeah. Yes, they really are. So just to finish off with, what was your first love in music? I mean, what was the thing which kind of grabbed you and went, you know what, I want to have a go at doing this?
I know, I can specifically tell you, I was 6 years old, and there was a Looney Tunes, like Bugs Bunny cartoon that it's a pretty famous one, but the entirety of the piece of the cartoon is a dramatization to the William Tell Overture.
Okay.
Which is also ironic, I know, because it's my initials and my name. But I was so obsessed with that piece of music. I got my dad to take me down to the local record store, and I bought an LP of Rossini overtures, and that was the first record I ever bought. Well, I didn't buy it. He bought it. But, you know, that was... So, yeah, I mean, the first few years, like up until probably 11 or 12, I was pretty only listening to classical music, big band jazz, folk music, like... You know, I'm a big history buff, so I was always listening to, like, you know, old ballads, you know, workers' songs, Civil War songs. Those were the early influences.
And what happened at 12?
Nirvana.
Excellent.
But I came back around to all the original stuff.
I knew we'd talk about indie rock
eventually. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Hey, William, it's been absolutely sensational to meet you for the first time,
Same
have you
mark.
On the program, and to see you play last night. And just to finish out with, we're going to have another song from you, aren't we? And again, if you'd like to introduce it, and if there's anything you'd like to say about it, please do.
This is another song off Goes West. It's called Call Me When I'm Breathing Again. And the title just sort of came to me as something that I don't know where it came from, but it was like, oh, that's kind of moody and dark. And this song sort of, it has a lot of different ideas going on. It's not actually in any sort of key. Like, it's sort of in C, it's sort of in F. It like drifts around a lot and never really resolves. And I kind of felt like it was almost like kind of modal music, as much as folk music can be. So, yeah.
Excellent. You are listening to Sideways Through Sound on 2SER 107.3. I'm live in session with William Tyler, all the way from Nashville here in Sydney City, finishing off our session this evening with a tune called Call Me When I'm Breathing Again.